be administered by a master who has relatively low management skills. I mean, they're pretty simple policies, and enforcing them are very simple. Getting people to accept them, that accept them willingly and understand the challenge, that probably takes more of a management skill and a leadership skill. But just implementing the policy, that's pretty simple.
Were you an officer of Exxon Shipping when the Exxon Valdez was designed?
Yes.
What were the basic design criteria for this vessel? What were you trying to optimize?
We were trying to use state-of-the-art technology to achieve the best fuel economy we could, to achieve the best and most appropriate trade-off between manpower and mechanical or automation. I'm not sure what other answer you're looking for.
No, that's fine. Was this vessel designed with the Valdez trade in mind?
Yes.
Was there a design criteria regarding suitability for operation in ice?
No.
So it was basically, to summarize, the ship was designed for efficiency, but there was not a design criteria specific to operating in icy waters.
It was designed for Valdez trade. I don't know that any tanker is, it's not an ice-breaking tanker, that's for sure.
Yeah, I realize that. Is the steel in the hull of the Exxon Valdez, is that of a different form than in previous tankers?
Yeah, it's a high tensile steel, which is fairly recent, but I think that our previous class of vessels, the Exxon Benicia and North Slope, are also built of high tensile steel.
How does high tensile steel differ in response to hitting an iceberg compared to previous?
I don't know, it's a higher steel. It's a higher strength steel. It has a higher yield point. That's the important factor to it.
Is it more or less brittle than non-high tensile steel?
I don't think brittleness is the difference. The difference is in its tensile strength.
Fair enough. Let's go, if you will, to the chronology that you submitted to us, or the Captain Deppy did, under Exhibit 4T, if you would, sir. This is titled Exxon Shipping Company, Exxon Valdez Casualty Response Chronology for the First 24 Hours.
Yes.
Chairman Lee Dickinson.
Okay, as of sunset Friday, Alyeska's three skimmers were at the site. Now, were you in command of those vessels at that time?
No.
As of sunset Friday, how many barrels of dispersant were available for you to use in Valdez?
There were 360 drums, each drum 55 gallons, in Alaska at the time of the incident.
Question was in Valdez.
Well, you don't use it in Valdez. You stage the airplanes out of Anchorage. You load the planes in Anchorage, where we had 160 barrels. You load them at Kenai, where we had 160 barrels. And the 45 barrels that were here on site, we could have moved them to Anchorage anytime we wanted.
And at that same time, what capacity of aircraft did you have that were capable of taking off an hour before sunset loaded with this stuff?
We had a C-130 on the way.
On
as
the way?
Of, yes, as of sunset Friday. It was airborne.
Airborne toward Alaska?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Ayarsi, thank you for responding to these questions. I have one more. It's clear from all you've told us and all you've provided us that that Exxon clearly has a very fine set of policies in place. Exxon Shipping Company does. It's also obvious, however, from what did happen, to all our dismay, that Captain Hazelwood was in command of this vessel, that an unlicensed or a mate without the proper endorsement was at the con, and that Captain Hazelwood tested at a fairly high level of blood alcohol shortly thereafter.
Dr. Loresh, do you have a question?
Yes, I do.
Can we hear your question, please?
Okay. You have the policy, something happened. Have you thought about, and could you give us any guidance on whether the problem that led to this accident was a result of flawed policies or of insufficient implementation of these policies?
Well, let me say that that I share everyone else's dismay, and maybe my feelings are certainly as strong as anybody's about what did occur. I'm not sure exactly at this point that we know enough of the facts, and I hope that this that the NTSB will be able to shed more light on exactly the reasons for the grounding. At this point, all the information I have still leaves me with some unanswered questions, including what impact on this whole incident you attribute to the alcohol issue. I think there's still a lot of questions open, and hopefully we'll get some guidance to help us understand the reasons for the incident.
But as a manager, is there something wrong with your policies or something wrong with how they've been implemented?
I'd really need more facts to respond to you. I don't believe the policies could be any stronger. I think the Bridge and Organization Manual is about as clear a document as I've ever seen anybody produce as to what a company expects of its people. So I don't believe that policy is where we need to look, although we certainly will be looking at policy hard. We've got a lot of lessons to learn as a result of this. We have a lot of rethinking to do on all facets of this, on operations, on response. There's a lot that we all can learn from this, that the industry can learn, and hopefully these hearings will help us get to those kind of items where we can pinpoint our attention.
Thank you very much, sir. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Captain Deppe. We have no questions. Mr. Colucciello.
Mr. Ayarsi, you mentioned that after Captain Hazelwood's rehabilitation, the fleet operation manager and the ship group coordinator were assigned to make visits, and I believe you said about perhaps two visits a month when he was in port to observe him, I believe also to discuss his problems with him. So obviously Captain Hazelwood knew the purpose of their visit, is that correct?
Yes, and I think he felt he was the most scrutinized employee in our company. I think he felt a little uncomfortable with it. Mm-hmm.
What I'm wondering is if I knew that someone was coming to visit me and observe me and for a particular reason, isn't it reasonable that an individual would be on his very best behavior during those periods? And I'm wondering how valid such observation periods twice a month would be.
Well, you know, that was the opportunities we had to visit with him. and they were day-long type visits. And what you have to look for is what are his conditions, what are his responses, how is he behaving.
But if it was perhaps a crew member aboard the vessel, and you had a similar program for that crew member, would the observation perhaps be assigned to one of the ship's officers or the master, and then
probably to the master.
And then what do you think the total sum of observation would be compared to what the observations were for Captain Hazelwood?
I assume it would be more frequent.
Mm-hmm.
So, to the extent there was more frequent contact.
Well, do you think that given the fact that there is very limited opportunity for observing a master, that perhaps the rules and the policy that you have might not be appropriate for a master who can be observed only at very limited times?
When we were reviewing the policy and considering the converse of that, actually, I thought was a very compelling argument, and that because we have such limited opportunity to supervise our masters, they're at home half the year, and they're on board ship the other half, and when they're on board ship, we could probably get to them 2 days or 3 days a week or a month. Because of that, the whole concept of rehabilitation is very, very important, because the only way we're going to get to masters with alcohol problems is if we can encourage them to participate in voluntary programs, that the whole rehabilitation concept has reinforced validity when you're talking about a master, because you're not going to be aware if he has a problem just because he is so isolated, that if you can't provide a facility for those people to seek help, if they are afraid of that, seeking that help, then we're never going to be able to identify who has a problem. So it cuts both ways. I agree with what you're saying as far as the follow-up being more difficult.
Well, do you think that there needs to be a program for Orrin to utilize the opportunity when he is on vacation for observations? Is there, or some follow-up during? Was there anything done during the periods he was on vacation to keep in touch and observe and monitor?
No, and obviously we have to study very carefully what more we can do. This incident has, in fact, caused us to change our whole policy within Exxon Corporation on rehabilitation. I'm not sure that the new policy, which has not been totally defined yet, but the objective of it has been defined, and I'm not sure anyone is more happy with that than we were with the original policy. It's been criticized highly within the Wall Street Journal, within the Washington Post. So there are arguments for and against both sides of the rehabilitation policy, and I'm not an expert on it. But certainly this incident has caused us to reflect on the whole concept of rehabilitation and how we follow up. At this point, the company's first response is to deny voluntary rehabilitation to those individuals, not deny voluntary rehabilitation, but to deny their ability to go back to their original positions. And as I understand it, many people are concerned that that will just drive it underground. So at this point, I'm not sure what is the best policy.
Thank you. No more questions.
Yes, sir. Mr. Rossi, have just two quick ones. Yesterday, Chief Mate Kunkel testified that while watching the sob gauges, he noted that the oil level was dropping at a rate of a very high rate, and that he estimated about 115,000 barrels of oil had escaped within 30 minutes. So given that, my question is, and we are not, the safety board is not we have a lot of expertise in certain things, but certainly not in containment. And do you think, in your opinion, that that amount of oil in that amount of time would certainly test the limits of technology as far as being able to contain something like that, even though you say you had, you know, some sort of a plan for possibly 200,000 barrels?
I agree with the point you're making. With that rapid a release of cargo, even if you had all the equipment that we now have in Prince William Sound stored around a corner, I'm not sure you could deploy it in time to have any effect at all. And you always have to face the fact that with current technology, even if by some chance you were able to corral this slick, which Friday night I think the governor said covered 18 square miles, even if you could somehow figure out how to corral that 18 square miles at the point in time that those gales blew up over 50 miles an hour, all that boom would have been destroyed. The boom we did have and weren't able to recover before the winds came up, in fact, was destroyed. So I think that as far as the oil on the water, and I made this comment this morning, and I obviously had an awful lot of time to think about it. I don't think there was a power on earth that could have removed that oil from the water prior to those winds blowing it that came up Sunday night, Monday morning, blowing it on to the beaches and the areas around Eleanor and Knight Islands. The only technology that could have worked or had a hope of working was chemical dispersant. But mechanical pickup, Admiral Nelson commented, Dave Kennedy of NOAA commented, and have continued to comment that that was just beyond mechanical pickup.
Yes, sir, and then one other final question, just and I just would like your comment on this. We have been asked, the Safety Board has, and we have done some similar accidents, nothing like this, but would you comment on the use or efficiency or effectiveness of a double hull, double bottom type ship in a, let's say, an accident like this? And I'll put a qualifier on it because I know that we and the parties have not technically had a chance to totally look at the damage to Exxon Valdez yet.
The discussion or controversy over the effectiveness of double bottoms goes back at least 15 years. I think there is general consensus that in a low energy impact grounding, such as a soft bottom or a slow speed, that double bottoms would be effective. The converse of that in a high energy impact grounding, high speed or rocky bottom, that double bottoms are not effective. Right after the incident, the grounding, when I got back to Houston, our own technical people had already begun, based on the extent of damage that has come out of the divers' reports, to begin to analyze whether that particular vessel with a double bottom would have spilled less oil or had less damage. Their conclusion was that there would have been no change at all, and if anything, the vessel would have been more critical as far as stability. I also asked a shipbuilder, NASSCO, to analyze their double bottom design. They did not have a double bottom design for this particular vessel, but they have one for a vessel that's very close. It's about 188,000 tons. They analyzed five cases of the type of grounding that the Exxon Valdez went through. They looked at five different cases and analyzed the stability of the vessel. In three of those cases, the vessel would have sunk as a result of their computer stability analysis. In one of those cases, its it's questionable. The data was not clear as to whether the vessel would have capsized or not. In only one case would, on the basis of their analysis, the vessel had survived. And neither we nor they believe that that case is real based on the latest assessment of damage.
Yes, sir. Thank you. May I request that the safety board be provided with a copy of that
yes.
technical report? Thank you, sir.
Mr. Danaher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Iorossi, I just have, you've been up here quite a while. I'll try to keep it short, but I have just two areas to cover. The first has to do with career advancement options that might be available to masters of the vessel. Is that, in essence, the end of the line for, not that it's a bad way to go, but for most masters, or how many of them, or how many positions in your corporate organization are available for further advancement? Should have.
I believe that 35% to 40% of the members of our shoreside staff have come from our fleet, from our fleet officer ranks, and they're all permanent positions. I believe only two are ex-masters. The problem being their salary is so high, it represents a significant debit to them in coming ashore. It's not high relative to what they do as a captain, but when you, the opportunities they have ashore are all lower paying jobs. So in essence, except for a few individuals, getting to be a ship's captain probably represents the height of their seagoing career, the height of their career with Exxon.
So a shoreside assignment is not likely to be a promotion then?
No, I think in a couple instances I know of, it represented a salary decrease.
Mm-hmm. The other area I wanted to discuss a little had to do with the composition of your fleet. You mentioned, I believe, that you have some older vessels and that you have retired some of them. I'm told that some of those vessels may have had a manning upwards of 40 crew. Is that the case?
No, sir, not within probably the past 15, 20 years. Some of the ships may have been delivered with crews of 42, but they're now operating with much lower crews because through the years we've added considerable automation to the ships, particularly as it pertains to engine room automation.
What would you say then is the maximum crew on any of your older vessels?
I believe it's 24.
Mm-hmm. And other than eliminating or reducing the engine room watch, what other, when you speak of automation, what other measures would lead to enabling you to reduce crew size?
A large part of the reduction had to do with the stewards group in that 42 complement going back to the mid-50s. I believe we had 7 members of the stewards department. We're now down to 3, I believe, on the non-automated ships. We've gone to, in recoating the vessels, we've gone to long-life coatings on all of our vessels to reduce the daily maintenance that the deck force would be involved in. I believe that just about covers it.
Okay. Did any of your studies in an attempt to reduce the manning include recommendations to hire newly graduated graduates of maritime academies?
We clearly, when we do hire, we clearly look for the best qualified and the best experienced people we can find. We've been fortunate in the past 2 years. It's unfortunate for the people themselves, but there's been many more graduates of the maritime academies than there were officer positions. So many companies are now, or have been past couple years, hiring graduates, academy graduates with licenses into unlicensed positions. We started that 1986. A number of those folks have moved up into the officer ranks, and we believe make better officers with the experience they do have. We haven't had opportunities for all of them, unfortunately.
However, does a degree and a mate's license necessarily make them a seasoned, able-bodied seaman?
Well, you have to compare it to what else is available, quite frankly. And it was our decision, looking at what was available from other sources, that that was clearly the best source for us to tap into.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Mr. Iarossi, if a crew member is has an alcohol problem and they go through a rehabilitation program and then they're reassigned to maybe another vessel, who's made aware of that on the vessel that they go to?
Within the past few years, the program has been totally confidential, so quite frankly, no one knows it.
So the master of the new vessel would have no idea that the individual has gone through a rehab program?
And the master would not know, I would not know, no one in the shipping company would know, and to my knowledge, no one in Exxon would know.
So in other words, no one would be able to check that individual? Except that the individual, him or herself?
That's true. The individual actually checks in with a separate company. Health, I believe it's Human Affairs Incorporated. They have offices spread throughout the U.S. The cost of that program goes to the medical insurance program, so Exxon doesn't even know from the standpoint of picking up medical costs. That goes through, I believe, Travelers Insurance or one of those companies, and that's also confidential.
So it's because of confidentiality that no one would know?
Yes. That's, I believe, one of these exhibits spell out the program as it's been for the past few years.
As a good manager, would you, if you were a master, like to know that somebody on your crew has been through and gotten help? Would you like to be aware of that?
Well, there are trade-offs involved. The confidentiality is the keystone of getting people to volunteer for the program, as I understand it. I didn't take part in developing the program. It's Exxon-wide, and there was a lot of outside consultation, a lot of outside support and study in going into developing this EHAP program. The cornerstone of it is confidentiality. Now, the trade-off is just what you're speaking about as far as awareness within the company. But in order to gain that awareness, most experts say you lose most of the participants. So in the end, you won't gain. Because without the confidentiality, people will not voluntarily go through the program. So in the end, you're not better off, you're worse off.
Okay.
But I'm not an expert in this area. I'm just my understanding of it.
I understand. Are you familiar with a program in the aviation industry known as cockpit resource management?
I've learned about the airlines programs. This is in relation to rehabilitation?
No, this is in relation to better communication between a pilot and a co-pilot in an airplane, captain and first officer, flight engineer, upfront flight attendants, better cooperation, training together, assertiveness training, those types of things.
I'm not familiar with it in any detail, no.
Is there anything in the marine industry that is akin to that? And I will coin a phrase, BRM, bridge resource management.
Well, I think the opportunity is there using a simulator to train teams, if that's what you're driving at,
that's
as far as getting team interaction centered around a bridge simulator. I believe that opportunity is there, should be there.
Initially, when cockpit resource management came into effect 10 or 12 years ago, there appeared to be a lot of hesitation with some of the old-timers. It was charm school, things of that nature. Would you think that would the same thing would apply if the marine industry attempted to push a program like that?
You mean as far as reluctance on the part of the participants? Perhaps, but I think it would be a distinct minority, and if the program made sense, I don't think that should dissuade a company from going through it. A lot of times, the initial reactions of participants are not the same as the reaction after they've gone through a program. Anything new will draw some sort of resistance, but it's been my experience that most of the time after people go through a program, if the program is well thought out, their opinion will change.
Do you think Exxon would be willing to attempt to be a catalyst in this area?
We're looking very hard at it right now, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Iorossi. Appreciate your time. You're excused.
Thank you.
I have 5 minutes to four. Before we break, I just want to introduce, thank you, sir, Mr. James Michelangelo is our regional field chief here. I failed to introduce him.
Thank you.
I have 5 minutes to four. Before we break, I just want to introduce, thank you, sir, Mr. James Michelangelo is our regional field chief here. I failed to introduce him on Monday. Jim, can you just raise your hand? Thank you. He's been very helpful to us in this hearing. And also, General Shero, Bill Shero has been here all week, and thank you, sir, Bill. Appreciate your time and effort. Let's take a 10-minute break, and we will be back with our next witness, which, by the way, will be Mr. Frank Flintz, because he has a airplane problem. So if there are no objections, we'll be back in 10 minutes with Mr. Flintz. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Flintz is a Coast Guard head, the assistant chief of the Merchant Vessel Personnel Division of the U.S. Coast Guard. The witness originally scheduled to come up after Frank Iorossi, whom we've just heard from, would have been Captain William Deppe. He is also one of the panelists asking the questions on behalf of Exxon, so I'm a little perplexed as to what they'll do when it comes Exxon's turns to ask questions of Captain Deppe. Be that as it were, we're about to take a break here. Frank Iorossi, the president of Exxon Shipping Company, had a relatively easy time today compared to some of the grillings he's suffered over the past 2 months. He talked about the company's drug policies and manning policies on the tankers in the Exxon tanker fleet. Coming up next, a Coast Guard person as we continue our live coverage. We'll just take a break here for about 10 minutes and figure to be back with you before very long. So that would put us at probably just a few minutes past 4 o'clock. And so I guess we'll send it back to the studio at this point. I'm Steve Heimel. I'm here with Bruce Melzer, and KSKA's live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board will resume after this short break. Stay with us.
John.